she comes.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is an old friend from Kansas City, Don Carroll. Don has been HIV positive for at least 30 years now and has dedicated the last half of his life to spreading the word that this is a disease you live with, not die from. Don's big job has been working with AIDS walks, which I have trampled with him in several AIDS walks in Kansas City, and so have hundreds of thousands of people have heard Don live in schools, auditoriums, television, and everywhere. Don, say hello.
Hello, Nate, from cold Don, Kansas City.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, Don's new book is My Dream to Trample AIDS. It's based on how many years of work?
Well, it's based on about 16 years of work, and it all started because I had a dream.
Tell us about the dream.
Well, I was in 1995. I was in the hospital with pneumocystis pneumonia. I had a CD4 count of zero. I weighed 119 pounds and wasn't really expected to live very long. And one night while I was in the hospital, I literally had a dream where I was told I was not going to die because I was going to go out and teach teenagers what they needed to know so they didn't get infected with HIV. And that started me on this journey.
Don, what did you do before you were diagnosed? What was your profession or avocation?
Well, I started off the early part of my life, I sold insurance and investments, but the years prior to being becoming sick, I owned a retail store and a restaurant.
Cool. Don and I both from Kansas City. I lived there for about 30 years of my life, and I went to a school and saw you in action a few times. You're amazing. You are amazing with kids. Nothing in your background. You never were a teacher. You never said you were a scout leader. You are absolutely mesmerizing in front of a group of kids, whether it's 30 or 700. Where did you learn that?
To be honest, I have no idea, because in high school, I was terrified to give a speech to 8 people. And when I had this dream where I was told I was going to be doing this, to be honest, I was angry. Partly because I didn't think I had the energy, but also because I didn't want to speak.
Uh-huh.
And I basically had a conversation with a friend one time and talked about, I really can't do this. I'm not a public speaker. And his advice to me was, you're never supposed to talk from your head. You're always supposed to talk from your heart.
Right.
And once I kind of figured out that I would be able to tell stories about how it felt to have this disease and watch my friends die, then it got to be an easy thing for me to do.
Great. Let me just give the listeners our call-in number. It's 805-830-8355. Just call that in, press 1, and you'll get in the queue, and I'll put you on the air. Okay. I have watched, as I told the listeners earlier, I have been in the audience and stood next to you. I think I stood next to you once when you gave one of your speeches. I can't remember which school. I think it was Shawnee Mission North. And things have changed. You held up a tackle box. I remember you holding up a tackle box one day filled with millions of meds. And it was kind of a scary moment. I looked out in the audience and the kids were like, tell us about that.
I'd even forgotten when I held up that tackle box. I still pass around a couple of containers of like the medication that I took like 5 years ago and what I took like 7 years ago, where there were literally 40 or 50 pills in the containers that were taken each day.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember some medications had to be taken on a full stomach, some on an empty stomach, some twice a day, some 3 times a day, and just the management of your meds used to be a full-time job.
Oh, sure. There was I don't know if you remember the drug Crixivan, but I think it was 2 hours before and 1 hour after you had to fast. So you spent 9 hours a day. You had to take it three times a day. So if you took this drug three times a day, you couldn't eat 2 hours before and an hour after, which means that in the day, in a 12, 16-hour day, you couldn't eat for 9 hours.
I remember Crixivan quite well because it gave me kidney stones. I ended up in the hospital on morphine for a week and then finally had to have surgery that I commonly call my Roto-Rooter surgery, and I'll just leave the audience to figure out what that entailed.
Isn't that funny that I remember the tackle box, and it's got to have been 15 years since I've seen the tackle box story. Now, if I remember the tackle box story, can you imagine what some high school kid, what that impression that left on them? You forgot the tackle box, but I remember that it was huge, and you had syringes in there. You had, I mean, it was like 75 or 80 compartment, big plastic clear tackle box. You don't remember it, do you? You probably do.
I do remember it, but it actually belonged to a good friend of mine named Bob that had passed away. And,
that's right.
And his partner gave it to me so that I could show people how Bob managed his medication and his treatment.
Right, right. Okay, tell us how you got involved with the Kansas City AIDS Walks.
Well, I grew up in Kansas City. I ended up going to K-State in Manhattan, Kansas. I stayed there 22 years.
Whoa.
Moved back to Kansas City in 91, and that's kind of when I got involved with the AIDS Walk. And I raised money on my own, and then I came up with this idea to try and recruit the kids that I was speaking to in high schools to walk with me in the AIDS Walk, and I actually formed an AIDS Walk team that was called Don's Teens Trample AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And
I have several
years. First year I had the team, I had 1,500 high school students in matching T-shirts that showed up at the AIDS Walk. It was an incredible event to see that many young people interested in HIV and AIDS.
Now, I have to remember, if you have 1,500 kids show up, that means you spoke to probably 15,000. You know, that one in 10, one in 100. Not every kid's going to get up and raise the money, you know, get the T-shirt. And the logistics of getting the T-shirts to 1,500 people must have been boggling.
It was overwhelming. And it was, to be honest, at that point in time, my health was better, but it wasn't great. So it was pretty exhausting and a huge task to get those T-shirts to people like before the walk so they could wear
right.
them the day of the
right.
walk.
Right, right. I remember I got mine. I walked in several of your walks, and then I actually later on I taught high school at J.C. Harmon High School, and I had my own team that walked with you. It was kind of a fun circle, and now we're here thousands of miles away doing this interview. Like small world. Okay. How have things changed that you've seen in your talks and in your education? What's changed in the last 15 or 16 years?
Well, a lot has changed basically just because people are basically living with AIDS now for a much longer period of time. So in some respects, I think it is hurt the prevention efforts because people don't see a lot of sick people. You don't hear on the news as often about people being sick. What you do hear is people are living longer, and I think people are still concerned, but I know in some groups, especially like young gay men, there's almost this attitude about it's not such a big deal because if I get HIV, I'll just take a pill.
Right. And I used to live in Kansas City, which is a much different place than Fort Lauderdale. I'm in Broward County, Florida, which is, I think, as of last month, the CDC ranked us as number one in the country of white gay males' new diagnoses. And they're all young. They're all in the 18 to 35-year-old age bracket. So you're exactly right. The fear is gone. The whole thing is turned into a nightmare as far as prevention goes for a lot of reasons. And you said the drugs are one thing, but don't you think it's part of it is that we're just not getting the message out to the young kids?
Oh, I definitely think that's the problem, and that's why I wrote my book, that the federal government spends 3% of their HIV/AIDS budget on prevention, which is pathetic.
Right.
And what's frustrating to me, if you look at the last decade, worldwide the infection rate has decreased 20%.
Uh-huh.
But in the U.S., the infection rate has not decreased at all. If anything, it's continuing to increase.
Right, right. And in certain areas, it's even worse. And I live in a large Latino and also transient gay community where a lot of, if you're an actor, you go to Los Angeles. If you're a gay kid, you end up in Fort Lauderdale or Miami. It's kind of the last stop on the bus trail here. And it is a huge problem. I don't work with HIV groups here anymore, but when I did, I was always surprised at the number of young people that showed up and didn't have a clue. I do blame George Bush for a lot of this because there was an 8-year gap where you couldn't teach it in schools or you couldn't have a condom in schools on federally funded programs. So there's this huge group of kids that went through school in that 8-year period. They got no education.
Yep. That's definitely true.
Right. So we
every
have
time
all that.
I hear about a state or school district preaching abstinence-only sex ed, I think they've never talked to a teenager.
Right.
I mean, I have thousands of letters from kids I know about their sex life, and they're having sex, and they're having it at younger and younger ages.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And watch TV. I mean, look at television. Everyone's having sex on TV and they're having it out of marriage, before marriage, during marriage. And it's turned into a national nightmare, not just for HIV AIDS, but STDs in general. I mean, it seems like there's been an explosion of this penicillin resistant gonorrhea and syphilis. And we won't talk about that. That's enough. Okay. Back to the HIV AIDS. What made you write the book?
Well, I was talking to more and more kids, and I've never charged to talk to high schools, but I've always asked teachers for evaluation letters. So I kept reading letters from kids saying, you know, that they'd studied it before, but they never really worried about it because they thought, well, if you get it, you die, or something like that. It was too abstract. But I kind of paint a picture of what it feels like to have it. So they would say, you're the first person to make me understand what it would feel like to have it. Right. And I knew my approach was working, but I also knew that no matter how many people I talked to, I was just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the book because I thought the government's not doing this. Maybe I can spread my message to more people.
Right. Right.
Good by deal. Putting it into a book.
Right. And a personal face, you know, and as I said, people can't see you. It's radio, but you're a very healthy, muscular guy, and it's hard. It's great that you're in great shape because it shows that it's a normalcy, you know, that this can happen to anyone, that you can't tell by looking that somebody is healthy or sick. And that's a huge thing for kids because we have seen some studies where people think they know what it looks like, what a person looks like with AIDS, which is ridiculous.
It's one of the first things I point out when I start speaking is that I actually have full-blown AIDS, and that none of them would ever guess that if they walked past me in the hallway.
Right.
And
right.
It's an eye-opener to them
that
the disease is completely invisible.
Correct. Correct. And especially today. I mean, not even especially today, but especially today with the drugs and the facial fillers and the steroid use, there really are very few physical symptoms. I mean, it's not like, you know, watching the movie Philadelphia and seeing Kaposi's sarcoma and wasting. That you don't really see that anymore. Yet it's still a devastating disease economically, socially, medically. I mean, there's all sorts of we're both of us are, I'm older than you, are aging with HIV AIDS, and we're finding all sorts of little time bombs in this aging with HIV. What do you think about that?
Well, it's true. I mean, like, perfect example for me, my health is good, but I'm at the dermatologist every 2 months getting skin cancer removed that has to do with my HIV status. And the statistics as far as the likelihood of having heart attacks or strokes or any other health problems are much higher for people that are long-term survivors.
Right.
And the expense of things is amazing. Right. At some point in time, in this country, unfortunately, I don't know of anyone that's HIV positive that doesn't worry that they might lose access to
their medication,
their health care.
Correct.
And there's an awful lot of people that don't have the health care.
Right.
So it's terrifying when you think, okay, I'm doing all right, but that's because I'm taking $40,000 a year in medication, and if
exactly.
I can't pay for it, then what's going to happen?
Right, and I don't know about Missouri or Kansas, but we've got a waiting list here of over 925 people in the state of Florida are waiting to get medication. They've been diagnosed, their doctors are ready, but we have an ADAP, which is the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which helps you pay for your co-pays and your drugs, obviously. It's $40,000 to $60,000 a year just for HIV meds, and we have 900 people. We have almost 1,000 people that are HIV positive. They've seen their doctors, and they're on a waiting list in this country. I just can't imagine that. I don't know what it's like in the Midwest, but
it's pathetic that we're supposedly the wealthiest country in the world, but yet we have people that aren't getting the medication that they need. And even things like ADAP and Ryan White, they have income limits so that if you make too much money, you don't get any assistance, and it almost forces people to stay in lower class standard of living, because if they make enough to be in middle class, it kicks them out of the programs and they don't get their medication.
Right. And then there's people like, you know, that even if you have private insurance, your copays keep going up and up and up and up to the point where it's not worth working anymore. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible catch-22. It's like if you have too much money, you don't get the assistance, but the prices of these drugs are going up probably 30-40% per year. I think that's what I read somewhere. Is that about right? Something ridiculous like that?
I think it is, especially from the standpoint that long-term survivors, usually their medication starts to not work as well because their virus mutates, so we're kind of forced to go on the newest medications all the time, and they, of course, are the most expensive.
Right. And then the drug companies do things like, you know, merge them into triple and quadruple drugs, which cost more than the drugs cost separately, which that one we'll talk about that on a whole other trip. But, you know, it really is not a fun thing to have. Even with the best of insurance and a reasonable income, it's still a devastating day-to-day issue. And you're right. I worry about my health insurance. My partner is on Medicare and has large copays. I mean, this is you're constantly worried. You're reading the paper. You're watching, you know, every bill that passes, every cut that's made. You're always looking at that. It's a terrible thing in this country that we have not taken care of our own people. And it's not just HIV/AIDS. It's diabetes. It's all diseases are in big trouble. All right, we'll talk back to HIV. All right, so are you still doing the AIDS walks?
I don't have my team of kids anymore because, to be honest, it just got overwhelming. I still collect money for the AIDS walk on my own every year, and I still know a lot of people that I got involved years ago that walk every year. And the AIDS walk is, you know, every year we need to raise more money because we have more people in care, but that gets harder because of the economy and also just because of the mindset that it's not as big an issue as it used to be.
Right. We don't have our Elizabeth Taylor. We don't have our Ryan White. There's no real – I mean, you know, we have Magic Johnson as a so-called face of AIDS, but he's not really been in the forefront or in any sort of the spokesperson. And in fact, there, I just read an article recently that one out of three African Americans believe he has been cured by the drug companies, and they're keeping the cure from the rest of the world. One out of three African Americans believe that, and so they're seriously.
That's,
This was a university study that I just read on thebody.com.
It amazes me that rumor persists, because years and years ago, when he went on protease inhibitors and his viral load went undetectable, he himself said, "Oh, I've been cured." And
right.
He since retracted his statement.
Right.
But it's amazing. I still hear people say, "Oh, I heard that he's cured."
Right.
So it
right.
just amazes me how falsehoods can hang on
forever. I mean, he just said it once, and of course, that was the time when Anthony. This was in the early days. I think he announced he was HIV positive in 91 or 92. Is that right? Something like that. And then, of course, when he went on protease inhibitors, Anthony Fauci said that it was going to be cured eventually in the first few months. So he was just repeating, you know, what somebody at NIH thought was going to happen, and of course didn't, because there are reservoirs of HIV in your lymphatic and in your organs that lay dormant and decide to wake up when you least expect it to, and as you said, the mutations and things like that. So there is that misconception, and I also think this is my personal opinion. I'm married to a gay psychiatrist, a gay HIV positive psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist from Dallas who now lives here, and he has theory that the reason this is happening is it's the seatbelt thing. Is that, you know, how many times are we told to buckle up our seatbelt, yet we read in the paper that there's an accident and the kids weren't wearing the seatbelt, or somebody wasn't wearing a seatbelt? I think the constant mantra of condom, 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 condom is now ringing deaf on a lot of people's ears. Do you agree with that, or think that's
I completely agree with that, and it's amazing to me from research, and I mean, current research says that if you're on treatment and your viral load is undetectable, you're far less likely to transmit it to anyone else, all right?
Right.
So some people are taking that as an excuse not to use a condom, which is crazy.
Right.
And in my, basically, if I sit down and talk to a gay or bisexual male who wants to know, you know, how do you prevent this, my advice is that if you can do about anything you want, but just don't have intercourse without a condom.
Correct. And there
Even activities like oral sex is considerably low risk,
right,
especially if someone has an undetectable viral load. But,
correct.
I mean, if I were going to tell somebody, I'd basically say you're probably going to eliminate 98% of your risk if you just don't have intercourse without a condom.
Correct.
Which is frustrating to me, having the disease and knowing how hard it is to live with, that people aren't willing to do that one simple thing to protect themselves.
Right. And the other thing is, even if you've got two HIV-positive men who are having sex without a condom, there's all these other STDs, you know, are going around, which we don't want to list, but they're, you know, herpes, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, the whole shtick. And there's, if you have HIV and you get one of these diseases, you're going to have a much more difficult time treating that STD. It's not going to be as simple because your immune system's already a little racked. But I'm amazed at the number of people that just don't seem to get that last little step. And as I said, there's a lot to do before intercourse. And you know, that isn't the be-all, end-all. But you're right. I'm always amazed that people say, "Oh, I'm undetectable. I don't have to wear a condom." And I'm going, Anyway, you're only as undetectable
or
as you're
amazed at people that say, "Oh, don't worry, I'm not infected, so I don't need to wear a condom."
Right.
When I did research for my book, one of the stats I found that really shocked me is that 45% of gay and bisexual men that are positive don't know their status.
Right. If you don't get
and
tested,
that kind of surprised me, because I would think that most gay and bisexual men would understand they're at risk, and they would get tested on a regular basis. But obviously I'm wrong in thinking that, because they're not.
No, they're not. If you don't get tested, then you're HIV negative. That's the theory. I think I've heard this crazy theory from people that, you know, once you get tested, it's out there. You know, it's not, even though it's anonymous and confidential, you're pegged. So the answer is not getting tested, and that to me is just a crime. It's an absolute crime, And, you know, that to me, it's amazing how many times I meet and talk to people. My partner and I co-host the HIV cruise every year for 7 years now out of Fort Lauderdale. And we actually get a lot of people calling us and emailing us and stuff like that. And some of them will not tell me their status. And I finally ask them personally one-on-one, and they say, oh, I just don't get tested. And I just, my jaw drops.
Well, and that amazes me, too, for another reason, that if you get infected and you start treatment fairly soon before mm-hmm. your immune system is damaged, the statistics say you're going to live a fairly normal lifespan.
Right.
But if you don't find out you're positive until you actually get sick, which is going to be 8 or 12 years after you got infected, you try and start treatment there, and you're not going to have nearly as longevity,
correct,
in your life.
Exactly. I mean,
so it's crazy not to be tested, because you can live a fairly normal life if you find out you're infected early.
Right, and there have been, you know, there are programs, and you know, testing is free in most cities. Testing is anonymous and or confidential in most cities and counties, and yet people seem to. The testing is the big thing. I read that too, that a huge number of straight and gay people who are sexually active do not know their status, and I'm absolutely amazed whenever I hear that. Have you ever run into any people who actually are looking out, bug chasers who are looking out to get infected?
I have talked to some people that have this. I don't know that they've said they're trying to get infected, but they're not doing anything to prevent it.
Right, right. I've talked to several people like that for various reasons. It's amazing. And one of the things I've noticed is one of them told me, says, you know, there's nothing for HIV negative young men that aren't buff and attractive and can meet people in bars. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, look at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. There's like 8 different support groups for HIV positive people, and there's none for HIV negative people. So we've kind of fallen behind on supporting and honoring those people who have stayed negative. And we've given a lot of good support to HIV positive people, but I don't think we've honored and supported the people who have stayed HIV negative. And I think that's going to be one of the things we need to look at in the next few years.
I completely agree.
Yeah, it's amazing.
People should be encouraged to be in that group and stay there.
Yes, because this ain't no fun, trust me. Listen,
no.
We have 2 minutes left. Okay, I'm gonna set up a little scenario, and I want you to answer as honestly as you can. So I put you in contact with a young Don Carroll. He's just about 35 years old. He is just raring to go, ready to put out his blog, his talk, his speakers bureau, and he's ready to go. What would you say to a younger version of yourself?
A younger version of myself that knows he has HIV
and wants to go out there and knock the world dead.
Well,
just like you
I would say, talk to as many people as you can and be as honest as you can. And one of the reasons I think I've been effective in talking to people is I lay everything out in front. I'm completely honest. You know, I talk about the side effects. I have one chapter in my book called Oh Crap that deals with the diarrhea that anyone that's on HIV meds is very familiar with. So
right.
it's being honest and telling people this is what's going to happen if.
Right.
That's what I would tell people to blog about.
Okay. Blog, talk, whatever. Just get out there and do it. Because I have a young friend who's 33 years old who lives in South Carolina, and he's got a wonderful blog and a speakers bureau, and I am kind of his little mentor that I'm his go-to guy for publicity, and I've just said, just wear out your shoe leather and do as much as you can. Get to the schools, get to the scouting, go out and do it, and it's amazing. You're exactly right. Listen, Don, we have like 19 seconds to go. I want to give your website. It's trampleaids.com. TrampleAids, com. You can order the book right from there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We want to sell that book and push, 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 right, don't we? Okay. Listen,
that's
Don,
true.
This has been great. We have like 3 seconds left. Good night, and thanks a lot.
Good night, Nate. Thanks.
Take care. Good night.